know, we were made to be the fullest image of ourselves and the fullest to our fullest capacity. We weren't made to be mediocre. And so I really believe that it's part of our purpose, duty, calling to fulfill your pure total potential that you've been given by your Creator. And I think that you can express that by overcoming fear and by moving in a place that's uncomfortable. I say all the time around here, we have to continue to be comfortable being uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. That's where the growth is.
Hey guys, welcome to the CRE Project Podcast. Hey guys, welcome to today's episode of the CRE Project. We are super amped. We have Steve Maestas of Maestas Development Group here with us today. This is such an awesome show. We have so many things that we talked to Steve about. Anything from building a brokerage, what makes a good broker, what questions to ask a potential investor if you have a commercial development project that you're trying to get off the ground, to just basic daily life practices that have helped him, influenced him in the business. So, you know, we got a lot out of this show. So sit back, relax, and just get ready to take it all in. Hope you all enjoy.
Good afternoon, CRE Project Podcast listeners. Thanks for being here today. Gann and I are amped to have one of the most influential and active retail developers in the state of New Mexico here with us today, Steve Maestas. In addition to being a retail developer, he was also with the Federal Reserve for a short period of time in his life. He is an active dad, which is probably where he's the most busy right now in his life. But Steve is a multidimensional guy, full of knowledge, and I think what makes Steve different and appealing is the fact that he's built multiple companies. So he's built one of the largest brokerages in the state of New Mexico. So he's been a very successful broker, been a very successful business owner, and also a very successful developer. So, Steve, thanks for being here.
Hey, good to be here.
So so starting out, if you don't mind, can you give our listeners just a brief, you know, kind of minute clip on Steve Maestas and how you got in the business and, you know, what you're currently doing?
Sure. So I started in the business working for a developer, and after about 6 months of that experience, he went out of business. He filed bankruptcy. And so I went to work for a developer because I didn't have the ability to support myself without a salary. And so then I was faced with the decision on going back into getting a traditional job or going into brokerage. And I really was attracted to commercial real estate. So pivoted into working with a strong multinational brokerage house, worked there for 7 years, was fortunate to do well, left that firm, started Maestas & Ward 23, 24 years ago, and really had a nice run there, had a great experience with that company. While I was working and leading that organization, I started investing and developing, and I've been doing that for about 25 years now, and had an exit with that company in the last couple of years, and so now I'm primarily focused on the development business and then a few other tangential businesses that I'm a partner and investor in.
Awesome. So what, I'm just curious, what kind of spurred you to go out and start your own brokerage versus staying at a larger house?
So the working at a larger house gave me exposure, and it gave me a fundamental education about the business and certainly an introduction into the business. I tend to be pretty entrepreneurial, and I don't really do great with rules. And when you work with a large company, one of the reasons why they're successful is they've got a platform and a program and a profile that works for that organization to advance the objectives of that organization. And so when you get someone that doesn't fit that mold, not that one's right or wrong, but it's just that there's not going to be a long-term alignment there. So for me, my growth had started to slow, mm-hmm. and some of the other things that I wanted to do that were a little bit more entrepreneurial, like investing and developing, was not part of the brokerage platform for that organization, understandably. So that's why it just made sense for me to move on and hang my own shingle.
Interesting.
And Steve, just to, on the high level, for some of the listeners who may be looking at commercial real estate as a possible career, or they're new in the business and they're wanting to become better at it, you started at a time and with a handful of brokers who have gone on to be very high-profile developers. What were some of the fundamental characteristics that you had implemented in your business to help you be successful? What differentiated you, and how did you achieve those successes early in your career?
Well, I think the characteristics are probably the same for most people, even though people can go about getting to that thing called success in different ways. It seems to me the thing that really matters first and foremost is, does the business agree with you? And I think this is a business that if it agrees with you, you wake up early and you stay up late, and it's not laborious to do that. Mm-hmm. I mean, you just identify with it. It's in your DNA. So I was fortunate that the business agreed with me and that I identified with it. Yeah. And so it wasn't hard for me to work long hours, wasn't hard for me to apply more effort than the next guy or gal, because I was interested in it. And I think that plays into, you know, someone's heart and their why. Why are they doing this? So for me, I think you can learn all of the technical skills. What's more interesting as a broker and then as a leader, I was really looking for, you know, what makes that individual tick. What are their soft skills? Who are they as an individual?
Yeah.
And who are they as a provider of service? How do they offer value and relationship to their stakeholders, their customers, their clients, and frankly the community and the people that they work with? So it was really all about the individual, about the person, who they were, and really what gives them their, you know, what I call their why.
Right.
You can learn the technical stuff. That's the easy part. I think the more interesting piece is the human engineering side.
And how long do you think that typically takes till someone can figure out whether it agrees with them or not?
My guess, so when I was leading my Estes & Ward, you know, just kind of thinking back, I would say 80-90% of the time I would know in the first 6 to 12 months.
Wow.
You could kind of see the patterns that evolved. And they were generally the same patterns. Once in a while, I would miss, and someone that I didn't think would be successful became really successful. And other times, there were folks that I just didn't think that they were going to get there. And
talking about Gannon here.
so
be
it's just
careful here, Steve.
But I think with all things, you can start to see patterns evolve when you have repetition. But I think in that first year, you have a pretty good idea on who's going to stick and who's
what,
not.
Out of all the experiences that you have with hiring brokers, what are the typical ruts that you see people start to move into you know, 6 months into the business, 12 months into the business. Because I find, you know, the most challenging part of brokerage is obviously that first year and just the mental mindset of it. So I'm just curious, what did you consistently see people start to do, and what was that sign that you're like, it ain't looking good?
Yeah, I think you know, it's lonely when you start, right?
Mm-hmm.
You don't know anything, and you don't know anybody, generally. And so you're really hoping someone will talk to you, even if they're not a good business opportunity. You're hoping to get some type of traction, and I remember having plenty of self-doubt. And I think, particularly for young people, that's an easy thing to experience when you're in this business that really the next two or three steps are somewhat opaque, and success is, you know, it's this nebulous thing, and you don't really understand how to do it and get there, and it really comes down to, in my thinking, the person's grit, and yep. If they have, you know, how much discomfort, how much pain are they willing to endure to get to a place that they understand is out there, but they don't know exactly what it looks like. And that's where this thing called faith comes in. And you've just got to believe, you got to stay after it. And as you move through these steps, these plateaus, things illuminate better. You get more clarity as to how to get to the next step, what success looks like, how to do things. But when you're starting early on, you hear the information, you're given the data or the direction, but to apply that and to master it and become proficient at it really does take a long time. And so you just have to stay in there and understand that failure is the number one thing that you need to incorporate into your business plan, because that's what you're going to do a lot of. You're not going to make a lot of money. You're going to make a lot of mistakes. And using that knowledge, that those setbacks and those obstacles, those headwinds, those failures, as your educational platform, so that you're more capable and you're empowered to be more effective, is really the formula that you need to understand is that you're going to adopt and go through before you can start to reap the benefits, the financial benefits, the recognition, the accolades, the affirmation that you're doing the right thing, because it doesn't come early, it comes later on. I found that if you do the hard things early, things become easier.
And what are the hard things?
So it's understanding that there is a mountain that you're going to climb before you're going to be rewarded in any meaningful way. The sales cycle is an extended period of time with commercial real estate. Mm-hmm. And so building that pipeline, building relationships the right way, prospecting, rainmaking, studying all aspects of the business, having complete knowledge and mastery over your market so you understand the inventory better than anyone else. You understand the nuances of a negotiation. What are the components of a lease that are tenant-oriented and that are landlord-oriented, and what are the fallback positions, and having proficiency and mastery on both sides of those, understanding those processes. You know, what are the seven typical objections to a transaction, and what are the logical responses to each one of those objections? Having the mastery and the proficiency, having all of those things built into your arsenal, if you will.
Yep.
Before you get the benefit, you've got to pay the dues before you get to have the benefit. It's chopping the wood before you get the warmth from the fire. And the reality is, it just takes a long time to learn all those things. Some of those are human engineering related. A lot of them are technical. But the faster you can learn those, the more intense you are about learning those, the quicker you will receive market validation, financial validation that you're doing the right thing. And what's interesting is, you know, it's a continual pattern. It as you get to one level of success, then there's a whole nother level that you're going to encounter. You know, being 25, 30 years in the business now, actually longer than that as I think about it, boy, I'm getting old. You know, I'm still learning. And I think that's a really key.
I think that's
key,
the most rewarding thing.
Yeah. It's really a key driver for me, and I think really fulfilling for people that have stayed in this business long term, that are forward thinking and that are leaders in the industry, is you're always learning, you're always growing. And that's really an important component to anyone's success in life, frankly.
So let's talk a little bit on that same note on mentorship. And I guess two questions. What do you look for in a mentee, and what do you look for in a mentor? Because I know you still have several mentors too.
Yes, so I think having mentors is one of the key components of success, and it just saves you so much time and gives you insight on blind spots that we all have. So having that resource, I have found, is really valuable. So with the individuals that I mentor, what I really look for is if I'm spinning my wheels or I'm adding value. And even though I might be saying something of value, is it going in one ear and out the other? I want to spend time with people that are passionate and have their blood, sweat, and soul and tears in whatever it is they're mm-hmm. doing. That will give a return.
And do you see that, like, how do you see the return on that, you personally, if you're mentoring
someone? Well, I find great value and fulfillment in helping others. And perhaps I do because I was helped so much when I was younger. And I know the value of mentors. As you mentioned, I still have mentors. So there's fulfillment in it. But over the long run, you can see those that are, you know, kind of going to define this a little bit. You can see the winners and the losers. And I want to invest in the winners, which has a lot to do with motivation and what their drive with. It doesn't have a lot to do with talent. Because you can obtain the education, the knowledge, you can obtain the soft skills if you're motivated and willing and committed and tenacious to go get those things. Motivation, the root word motir, Latin word, means from within. So we're really not going to change people. All we're really doing as mentors is giving them paths and illuminating the next couple of steps, maybe inspiring a little bit. But it's really, ultimately, it's up to that individual to apply whatever you're sharing, whatever you're giving them, to their situation. And you can kind of see if it's, you know, if they're on track, you know, if they're making progress or not. So for me, it's I think kind of proof's in the pudding. As it relates to what I look for in a mentor, I think you can find knowledge with those that are greater and lesser than you. And for me, what I'm specifically looking for, you know, that's what, you know, if I'm trying to develop more emotional intelligence, then I'm going to orient towards someone that is highly skilled in that area. If I'm looking for better financial acumen in a certain area, then I'm going to work towards that. So I'm really deliberate about where I get my information and how it feeds the things that I need to work on.
Interesting. What do you feel like, and, you know, now, again, you being more on the ownership side of things, when you go to hire a broker, again, I know it's probably what they specialize in, so on and so forth, but what are kind of the key traits that you look for in a broker?
Well, I think a lot has to do with what the project is. So the first thing that I try and do is I try align the real estate professional with what the asset is. Mm-hmm. So if we have a Class B small strip center, that's a different profile broker than you know, a 50-acre, 500,000 square foot
sure.
community center or power center. Yep. So I think that's very important to align that skill set and that interest level on that time capacity.
Network as well.
Yeah, all of that. And so we try and get alignment there. And then after that, you know, really it's about, for me, it's really about, do I have relationship with the person? If I don't, can I trust the person, and can they add value? And so we're fortunate that in this market, we've got a lot of relationships. In some of the other markets that we're toying with, we don't have those relationships. So we're looking for more skills in those other places. More skills are really the thing that we're going to rely on, and what their relationships are with retailers or with landowners. But at the end of the day, I have found that we orient to doing transactions with people that we know, people that we like, and people that we have a level of trust with. And so that's really the thing. I think having the skills is table stakes. You got to have that at whatever level that project needs. And then after that, it's really those three things. And then I would also add, at different times, different people are better because they've got more time, they're more passionate about a particular project for sure, whatever reason. Mm-hmm. So you also have to kind of measure where they're at and what works for them. It's a little bit different today than it was, you know, when I was back in the brokerage business, where it wasn't as refined and it wasn't as
scientific.
Yeah, you kind of were a jack of all trades in a discipline, and
sure,
you could do pad sites, you could do shop space, and if you were really good, you could do boxes as well, and you would sell a center. Today, specialization is everything.
Yeah. Steve, I just love listening to all your answers and feedback. One thing that we always like to talk about is your transition from brokerage to development. Can you share with our listeners a little bit about what that looked like for you personally, and what that project was, how you structured it? Did you bring in partners, and contrast that with what some of the stuff you're working on today looks like?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, Gannon. I got into the real estate business because I was interested in ownership and development. And the path for me was brokerage. And what brokerage did was two things. It gave me knowledge and it gave me financial resources. So I learned about the business and I was able to sustain myself with the brokerage platform. I loved the brokerage business. I built some great relationships. I've benefited from some wonderful people being surrounded by and supporting me over a long period, over 25 years working at two different organizations. But my ultimate desire was to be on that equity side for probably two reasons. One, there's a real satisfaction you get with having an impact in the community. And I think that's really, really important. So you can do that as a broker. There's no question. I think you have more influence as a developer and as an investor because you touch and implement more things that can have an impact on the community. And the second, which is higher risk, but there's a higher financial reward.
Right.
So those two things have always appealed to me. For me, it was a long process. And while I was doing brokerage and then leading a brokerage company, I had the good fortune to start investing and developing. And there just became a time where the brokerage piece of it was less challenging to me because I'd, been in it for a long period of time.
Sure.
And the development business was more demanding. So it made sense for me to transition out of it.
Did it feel natural to you as a progression?
Yeah, I think so. I probably stayed in the brokerage business too long.
Mm-hmm.
But I stayed in it probably too long because it was a really good business.
Right.
And I had great relationships and I really enjoyed the process and I really enjoyed the people. So it's hard to walk away from something that's not broken,
Yeah.
It was working and it's
still riskier.
Yeah. So, it's easy to stay with what you know.
Yeah.
So, but they're different businesses. The industry is the same, but the skill sets are different in terms of the day-to-day activities. The leadership components may not be that different, but certainly they're different businesses within the same industry.
Yep, absolutely.
Can you tell us about your first deal?
So my first retail deal was a shopping center called Coors Central Shopping Center that was located at the intersection of Coors Central.
Good name.
And and I tried to buy it from a from this entity called the RTC. Didn't get it. A fund out of New York bought it in a pool. We ended up buying it from that fund. And it turned out to be a wonderful transaction. What was interesting about it was, you know, how much we learned and how many mistakes we made. So I didn't have any money. I didn't even own a house at the time.
Wow.
So I was in the business for 4 or 5 years and was really terrified to buy it. But I was fortunate to have a sage man hold my hand and take me through the process. We raised $500,000. I didn't know how to raise money, so I called a friend who was a banker that had business relationships, and he raised $500,000. And we both negotiated a 6% carried interest in the deal.
Mm-hmm.
The deal was so good, we could have had a 60% carried interest. But, you know, we just didn't know that we didn't know. We owned it for 16 years. The five investors that we had were well rewarded. We were well rewarded. I think I ended up with 35-40% of the center. It's a great first deal because we made a lot of mistakes on the structure of the partnership as the sponsor, but it was a fabulous deal. So everybody won, and I'm thankful that I had one that worked versus one that didn't work. You know, that first one's kind of a defining moment.
Yeah.
You know, a lot has changed since then. We've learned a lot more.
Sure, absolutely.
So did you actually sign like the purchase agreement and everything on that?
I went through the entire transaction. These were limited partners. I met one of them.
Wow.
So the other four I never met.
So when did you engage getting partners on this? Was this prior to signing the PSA or after?
I don't recall exactly what the timing, the sequence of those events were. I would say that it was pretty simultaneous.
Because I just wonder if you were, you know, naturally you'd be more nervous not talking to anybody. Because I'm sure you identify it as a good opportunity, but I'm sure you wanted to bounce it off of a few people. Hmm. And I'm just curious, you know, if you, at the time, were sitting there saying, you know, I'd like to get a second take on this before I put it under contract. Because it's so interesting to me, and I know we've talked about this before, but that's so... As brokers, we draft purchase agreements and seed leases all day long. But when you actually physically go to sign one yourself, it's a different ballgame.
You read it
differently. You know, it just feels different. So yeah. I was just curious where your mindset was at.
Yeah, it's a different psychology with, okay, I'm going to receive a check for a fee versus I'm putting my stones on the line,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
And I remember being terrified. What I do recall was that the center was 79% vacant.
Wow.
And we were buying the shopping center for $1.81 a square foot for the land value, and you got the center on top for free.
Wow.
So I knew it was a good deal, and the gentleman that was helping me with the transaction validated that for me. So I didn't go look for third-party validation outside of that. I knew it was a good deal. Doesn't mean I wasn't scared.
Well, and I know and not to interrupt you, but I'm sure it had to have crossed your mind that this thing is 79% vacant, so no one's there. Is there a reason that no one's there? I mean, that had to have crossed your mind.
Well, and I understood why no one was there, because we had just gone through a recessed environment, and the Tax Reform Act of 1986 had taken effect on a lot of these investments. The center was early. There was too much built, But this goes back to knowing your market. Mm-hmm. I was a small shop leasing guru. I mean, I was doing 50 leases a year. I understood what Supercuts wanted. I understood what Sally Beauty wanted. And so I knew that we could fill this center. I didn't know how long. I didn't know if we were going to get $12 or $20 rents. But I just had the gut that was validated by my experiences over the last couple of years in other transactions that there was a market opportunity here. At the end of the day, you don't know. And so you just, it's like with anything. There's a ton of good ideas out there. That's not the issue. The issue is taking that first step and then following through and staying with it. And I think that's the number one impediment with entrepreneurship and with personal and professional growth is we have these ideas, we have these notions. It's, okay, I'm actually gonna follow my heart. I'm going to overcome the fear. I'm going to, you know, display courage and move forward with this. And I know I don't have it all figured out, but I'm going to do it anyway. And that's painful.
It is. It's extremely painful.
It takes courage.
Yeah, but what happens is the fight isn't outside. The fight is between, it's between your two ears. It's in your head. That is the fight.
Yeah.
And I think it's so easy to talk yourself out of opportunities and out of deals and, you know, these self-limiting beliefs that we continue to battle. We all have them. I promise you, everybody has them at every level. It's just how do you manage them?
Mm-hmm.
You know, fear exists for everybody. These generally are experiences that appear to be real that aren't real. And this thing called worry is an orientation that really doesn't serve you well. But that's the spice of life. I mean, that's you know, we were made to be the fullest image of ourselves and the fullest to our fullest capacity. We weren't made to be mediocre. And so I really believe that it's part of our purpose, duty, calling to fulfill your pure total potential that you've been given by your creator. And I think that you can express that by overcoming fear and by moving in a place that's uncomfortable. I say all the time around here, we have to continue to be comfortable being uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. That's where the growth is. If we didn't take that first step, we may have never taken the second step. So,
what's the most effective way in your past that you've overcome fear? Is it, you know, through numbers? Is it through just an overall gut feeling? I mean, what's been the most effective form of calming your fear?
So I think it's a little bit of both. I think you've been given a gut that really serves you well. Have to do your homework. Have to understand the mechanics. You have to understand the fundamentals. But also, you know, your gut is a great tool, and it's there for a reason. So it's probably a combination. Ultimately, it's applying action. It's just doing it.
Yeah.
And you get better at doing it because you're more comfortable with it because you've done it, you know, time and time and time. It's kind of like a muscle. You know, when you start working out, man, it's really painful because you haven't been working out. You're sore. You can't lift a lot. You can't run fast. Whatever it is. Over time, you get acclimated. You get stronger. You adapt. I think the same principle applies to this.
And going back to the development question, the opportunities that you were presented with early in your career are not the same opportunities that are available today. You know, the deal that you just talked about looked like a value add retail redevelopment deal where you came in, improved the center, got some new tenants, increased the rents, stabilized it. What does that look like in your world today as far as the opportunities that you enjoy pursuing?
So I think we, you know, our formula really comes down to a couple of things. So one, we've got to add value. Mm-hmm. If it doesn't add, if there's not a value add component, which can be new construction or repositioning, can be marketing, can be capital, we've got to be able to add value.
So
that's fundamental. Do I think the centers out there or the buildings out there on a price per pound or at the deep discounts that we saw during the RTC days? No, but they certainly were around the recession.
Right.
So you'll see that dynamic every 15 to 20 years. So I may get one more of those in my career, where you have that deep discount. But outside of that, I think for us it's value add. Second thing is we exist to make this place better. We have to be able to make a positive impact on the community.
Mm-hmm.
If we can't do that, then it's probably just not, it's just not the right project for us.
So you have a social impact consideration.
I think every developer should have an ESG policy. I mean, you've got to be able to. We're in a different world, and if you're not addressing environmental, social, and governance issues in your business, then I think you're missing a big opportunity.
Yeah.
And I think, quite frankly, the market and the world is. We're not at the point where it's demanding it, but we're moving there, and it's really going to be core to any forward-thinking, enlightened, leading organization. That's going to be core in all of them.
Absolutely.
You've already seen that on a broader level with some of the advanced publicly traded companies out there.
Okay,
that's important. So value add, impact, and then it's got to fit within. It's got to fit within our tribe's capacity. So we have a lot of deal opportunities, but we can't execute on all of them. So it also has to, there's a risk return thing. And for us, it's really about human capital. You know, how much time, how much effort, how much energy does it take to execute on this opportunity? And what is the financial and the impact return that you get? So, some of these projects that we've been working on for 15 years have significant financial and social impact, right?
Yeah.
But we're a small tribe, so we can't go out and effectively execute on four or five of those.
We can
only do a couple of them at a time.
Yeah.
So a lot of that has to do with what our capacity is and where we're at in our business cycle as well.
Yep. Great.
Talk to us a little bit about, speak to the listeners right now that may have a deal that they're looking at and they need to raise some capital. What are the key metrics that one should look for in a partner, and basically to put together the side of raising capital? What are questions that should be asked? I mean, just some of the basic things that someone should look for.
Yeah, so the first thing is alignment. I think you have to have alignment with your capital structure and understanding what your passive capital is trying to achieve, what that risk tolerance is, what that yield expectation is, what that time horizon is.
And not to interrupt you, but how do you do that?
You ask.
You just ask them, what do you expect?
Yeah, so most capital, small businesses, I assume most capital is raised by friends and family.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you get into institutional and more sophisticated syndicates, it's a different deal. But just on the friends and family side of things, you should know what that capital is looking for. And if you don't know, you definitely need to be asking, because you're marrying that capital, and so you want to make sure that you're equally yoked and you've got alignment. Alignment is really, really important. So I think a lot of times that is something that fundamentally becomes the challenge when things don't work. Then the other piece of it is, what's the risk tolerance? If you've got capital that is highly sensitive to preservation of capital,
mm-hmm.
that's a different transaction than if you've got entrepreneurial capital.
Mm-hmm.
So the decision to invest in a triple net lease is a different decision versus investing in a startup, mm-hmm. right? Those mm-hmm. are very different decisions and different capital profile. So I think understanding what the capital is trying to achieve, what that risk tolerance is key and fundamental. At the end of the day, in that segment of friends and family, it's about relationship and then understanding what the balance is between sponsor benefit and investor benefit. And I would say if you're not solving for your investor, you're probably taking the wrong approach, because that's the lifeblood of your next transaction. And if you don't get your investor piece right, you won't have an investor tomorrow. And if you get your investor piece right, you will have all the investors that you need. And so, because investors talk, and
absolutely,
and they reinvest,
yeah,
right. So I think it's really, really important.
So these days, obviously, now that you're more seasoned in the business, more successful, are you continuing to take on partners and seek investors for projects?
Yeah. So I would say 60% of our projects have an investor profile to them. And the other 40%, we self-fund. Depends on the transaction mm-hmm. and the cycle, but that's roughly where we're at. It used to be reversed. We actually used to fund 80% of our projects, but as we've grown and the capital requirements for some of these larger, more complex projects has demanded more capital, we've moved to more of an investor relationship profile.
So, and this is a question I always ask, but how do you, when you first took on your first project with other people's money, how scary was that? Can you just tell us a little bit about that? Because that's what I always worry about personally is, you know, if I'm investing in a project, you know, and you have other people's money, you know, basically, you're responsible for it. It's a stressful thing. So how did you kind of navigate those waters at the time?
Well, I think it goes back to that first transaction that we did. So for me, I remember understanding what the markup, what the value add was on the deal. One of the things that we solved for, and we did it in a much more archaic way back then, but we solved for a worst case scenario. We stress test things. We figure out what that break even is. So we try and find objectively all of the downside risk and understand how to mitigate it or what the worst case scenario would be. But at the end of the day, you've got to have confidence in your abilities and understand that what you know will serve you. You are making some assumptions, but they're educated assumptions, and then it goes back to, you know, if you know that this is a good deal and you're solving for your investor, 9 times out of 10, things are going to be okay. You're not going to make the timing the exact. I have yet to see a transaction that works exactly the way that you predicted. Sometimes better, but sometimes not there in terms of timing. So being really humble,
yeah,
you know, approaching these deals with great humility and being very realistic with your investors, not overselling, not over promoting, explaining the dynamics and the context, I think is really, really important. And I think investors can smell that. They can see if you understand your deal. They can see if you understand your market and if you have market cred.
So. And Steve, we want to be respectful of your time here. So as we're moving towards the end of the show, I have a non-real estate related question. You've always promoted and preached self-improvement and continual self-education. What would you suggest or advocate that some of our listeners could implement outside of their work life to continue to get better? I mean, anything in your world that you're doing that's worked for you?
Well, I would say a couple of things. So I think that if you If you want to get better in whatever aspect of life that is important to you, the simple formula is change your routines. You change your routines, you change your life. And I think one of the challenges we have is focus and attention. That really is one of the biggest commodities today. It's not information, it's focus and attention. So what you focus on and what you give attention to is what's going to change. It's what's going to grow. So if you focus on Twitter and email and responding to all of the information that's out there in the world, that's where your energy is going to go. That's where your attention is going to go. And you're going to dilute some of the maybe more important things that you need to be perhaps thinking about or working towards. So if you want to learn another language, or you want to improve your spirituality, or you want to get better at business, whatever it is, you've got to have the discipline, the daily discipline, to move toward improving that. And it's really a long game. It's an accretive strategy, like investing. It's an accretive strategy. So I would say, change your routines in the areas that you want to change your life. Number one. Second thing I would say is, you know, if you take, and I was told this a long time ago, like 30 years ago, if you take 3% of your income and you reinvest it in your continuing education, you'll never really go for want with regards to financial growth or success or whatever it is you're trying to accomplish. So you have to continue to reinvest in yourself and continue to learn. That's a core fundamental thing that's so so necessary in a world that is changing so quickly.
Sure.
And there's an abundance of information out there that's frankly free.
Yep.
But I have a strategy on continuing to learn in areas that are of interest to me, that are both business related and outside of business.
Yep.
So I would say those would be two things that I would be.
What's an example of changing your routine that you feel that has benefited you the most?
So for me, one of the things that I've really been hot and cold on is my discipline with working out. And as you get older, it becomes much more important.
Yeah.
So little things like, first thing I do in the morning is I stretch. I stretch every morning. Mm-hmm. That simple thing has made a remarkable difference. And it takes about 5 minutes. The next thing I do is I drink 20 ounces of water with lemon in it. And why do I do that? Because your body is dehydrated, number one, and you have an acidic, alkaline struggle, if you will, going on in your body. And you've got to get your body hydrated, and you've got to keep your swelling down. And swelling and inflammation is probably one of the biggest drivers of all kinds of problems in your physical.
And people don't realize that health starts in your gut.
It's so simple.
Yeah.
And so when you can adjust your acidity and your alkaline levels by ingesting water and lemon, just those two simple things, big deal.
Sure.
And then getting in the gym or walking or whatever that is for you, staying committed to,
hard.
30, 45,
yeah.
An hour, whatever it is for you, 5-6 days a week. And you might have to start with 3 days a week and build up to it, but you got to stay on it.
Yeah.
You don't have your health, you don't have anything. So I would say that one of my daily, and I have it written down, I've got 10 or 11 daily disciplines, and I have to put a check mark by doing that stretch.
That's great.
Drinking that water, doing that workout every day. And then I can look back and say, did I do it or did I not do it? You know, there's no negotiation.
Yep.
Interesting. So three more questions. So what do you feel like your personal brand is right now?
I'm not sure I know. I would like to think that we are adding value, we are making a difference, and we are making this place better. That's certainly something that I feel is core to who I am and what this company stands for. I think the first 25 years of my career, I was scratching and clawing to be successful, mm-hmm. whatever that means. And I'm hopeful that the next 25, if I'm allowed to live that long, it will be more significant. I'm not sure what my personal brand is. I don't know that I think a lot about that, honestly.
So you mentioned it earlier, but I actually heard this morning from Simon Sinek. But what is your why? Why do you do what you do? Why do you take on these financial risks? There's got to be a big picture there. What is your why?
Yeah, so if you defined my why, it would really come down to two things. And one is making sense of things that are complicated and having contribution. So those are things that drive me to the core. That's part of my DNA. I've got to make sense of things. And I'm attracted to things that are in our industry complicated. And the second is I get great fulfillment and I have to continue to contribute. And that's time, treasure. There's all kinds of different ways to do that. How that manifests itself in our business and what our purpose for existing is simply that we exist to make this place better. And we do that through commercial real estate development.
And then I was going to say, I got one last one, which is always a fun one. But, and this may have not happened yet, but what is your made it moment? What is the moment that you've just said, whether it's happened already, because it may have happened already, but what is that in your life where you just sit back and you say, you know what?
In a lot of other people's perspective, they'd say, that man is made.
Yeah.
You know?
So yeah.
It's
yeah.
A personal
so
question.
What is your personal made it moment?
I would tell you that when my daughter is a successful human being, I will have made it.
That's what
there
you made
you
it.
Go. Yeah. Amen to that.
Good stuff.
Steve, for our listeners that want to learn more about Steve Maestas and Maestas Development Group, what's the best resource to provide them with?
Go to our website. You can learn a little bit about us there. Always happy to talk to people. Always happy to share information and to add value.
And the website is?
www.
MDG Real Estate.com.
There we go. I don't know my own.
MDG Real Estate.com.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know my own website. I don't know my own phone number. There's a reason. Yeah.
And we'll have all of that in the show notes also. And we can't thank you enough, Steve, for being here. And you've been so gracious with your time. It's just so much value and so much information.
And then other than that, we appreciate your time and we are signing off.
Hey guys, thanks a lot. Enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Hey guys, we hope you enjoyed today's episode with Steve. I know we certainly did. As always, if you enjoyed today's episode, please tell a friend, tell a family member, tell a neighborhood, tell a colleague, tell a stranger. Tell everybody. We certainly appreciate the help getting the word out about this show. And as always, if you need additional information about Steve, feel free to visit our website, thecreproject.com. Other than that, go out and have a great day. Signing off for now.